versus Cowan. Mr. Friedman.
May it please the court. The heart of this case is whether the petitioner was denied a fair trial when trial counsel did not properly cross-examine a critical material witness due to either the state's withholding a key document or due to his own ineffectiveness. Whether a different cross-examination of the critical witness, Martha Jackson, would create a probable cause or more than a negligible chance of acquittal. The fact of this unusual capital case was that the defendant was accused of shooting and killing a co-worker's husband, Jimmy Christian. The motive of this killing was that he was romantically involved with co-worker Nadine Christian. The only evidence of this motive, being romantically involved with the deceased wife, was the testimony of another co-worker.
What was the aggravating factor that led him to be sentenced to death?
He had committed a previous murder at another time.
That's what it was.
That's the sole aggravating factor. Had he not been convicted of another murder, the actual facts of the case itself would not have been the death penalty case mm-hmm. itself.
What, in your view, was the most damaging testimony from Martha Jackson?
The most damaging part of the testimony is when she actually showed the motive, that final piece of mosaic, because all they had was, and I'll get into it later,
right,
about the
confession, of course.
It's confession, of course, and I will allege, of course, and that, but...
Right, not a dead person, too.
What?
Well, they had a death.
Well,
also.
And the key factor of the Martha Jackson testimony is show that there was some evidence of the motive. Obviously, you don't need motive to prove the case, but motive is important in convincing a jury. And the motive was, it showed, her testimony showed, without any relative cross-examination, was that that our client, John Pecoraro, was romantically involved with Nadine and therefore was involved in killing her husband.
Said yes, that, but now, tell me if I'm wrong. Didn't she tell this fact to the police long before they knew of her murder for hire contract?
Yeah, that's correct. But she originally had not given that information at all. In fact, pretended that she really even knew who John Pecoraro was and said, this guy John, and I don't know where he lives. So she gave a prior, first inconsistent statement about that. And then she then gave the information and then ultimately was not truthful in a polygraph test and then ultimately confessed up what she believed, which, that she had a involved in solicitation for hire for murder.
I don't actually understand your answer to Judge Rovner's question.
Well, I'll try to repeat it. I mean, Martha
did stuff with a polygraph case coming
in. That's correct. Originally, they brought her in and polygraphed her. And originally, she denied any knowledge of it. And then after not being giving truthful answers to a polygraph, then she started talking to the police officer and gave a different version of the events.
See, here's what I'm trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. She told this fact, the romantic involvement fact, long before the police knew of her murder for hire contract on her husband.
Yes.
And so what I'm wondering is what would have been her motive to lie at that point?
It's hard to reach. The factual patterns of this group is rather unusual. I mean, it could have been a motive that she knew that John had committed a murder and that she wanted to hire him and John didn't want anything to do with it. There could have been multitudes of reasons. But, I mean, a key point is that she was also inconsistent with the police and the prior statement.
I'm still lost. I don't understand.
Okay.
I thought the question was simply, if she mentioned this evidence before she was suspected of having hired Pecoraro to kill her husband, what difference would it make that later she had a motive to repeat that? I mean, she'd already told them that. What difference would it make?
What difference
would it have with the jury?
What would it mean? What value would it have in front of the jury?
Yeah.
One value that it would have is that evidence that she would have unsolicited type of activities make it less worthy of belief. That she changed and gave three versions of the event, and then ultimately believed that she was entering into such a contract, making her less credible. Less credible,
less credible or just less savory?
Our position is would be less credible in front of the jury. That
well, wouldn't you just be throwing dirt at her? Just the same sort of thing you don't want thrown at your client.
No, I don't think so. I think that the inconsistencies of her testimony. I think what's even actually, as a practical matter, what
consistent
is
consistent or inconsistent? Getting back to Judge Rovner's question, what earthly motive did she have when she first spoke to the police to fabricate a romantic involvement between Pecoraro and the wife of the victim?
She might have been upset at Pecoraro for not entering into a contract to kill her husband. She might have had a motive that was inconsistent. If originally she did not want to tell the police anything, and she was not truthful at the first time.
Let me ask you a kind of fundamental question. I don't know the answer to it. Since this is an unusual case because it doesn't involve any challenge to the sentence as such.
That's correct.
Just as if you've gotten 20 years. Is our standard of review the same?
I believe so,
Of the guilt issue? So the sentence really is irrelevant.
In this case, yes. There's a lot at stake for my client. But I believe that you evaluate the guilt and innocence claims. That's correct. He's contending that he's innocent, and obviously he has indicated no desire to raise sentencing claims because his assumption that he is innocent of this case.
At the time of the trial, was there any way the state could have prosecuted Martha Jackson for solicitation to commit murder?
Well, I mean that's an interesting question. I believe that they probably could because she gave a confession. The question is, they say they could not, but then they ultimately will tell you in this case that they could have prosecuted her without Martha Jackson's testimony, John Pecoraro, but by comparison. And so I believe that there's some inconsistency on their part. I believe they could have prosecuted. She signed an affidavit saying she did this. I mean, whether they could win the case is something else, but they clearly could have prosecuted. I mean, in dealing with the prejudice prong, I think, obviously, Judge Posner indicated, yes, there's an alleged statement out here that he confessed to a crime. And our position is that statement alone is not highly reliable. I mean, the statement was unsigned. The oral statement was not taped or videotaped. The petitioner refused to sign it. The petitioner didn't sign any written waiver of Miranda warnings before the alleged statement to the police. Even the police officer interviewing the petitioner indicated that the petitioner had consumed alcohol and about 1 3/4 grams of cocaine. And this information was ultimately testified to.
Well, what is the effect? I understand how the cocaine, you know, like liquor, might reduce a person's inhibitions, make him more likely to confess. But what's the theory under which it would cause someone to fabricate, to think he'd murdered someone when he hadn't?
Well, our expert said if you drink, I mean, I don't know. Maybe.
Has there ever been such a case?
Where people have given false confessions? I mean, we've had a
lot. Well, I mean, you could have a confession beaten out of someone, but do people, when they get seriously drunk or high on drugs or something, do they then confess to murders that they hadn't committed?
Right.
Is there any case in history where that happened?
Well, our expert said it could happen.
Did he say it has happened?
Not the affidavit has, no. But I mean, we do know.
Well,
I mean,
anything could happen, but if it's never happened in the annals of criminal justice, it doesn't sound highly plausible. Have you ever heard of anyone doing that?
No, I have not. No, I have not.
Well,
but I
would a jury? Wouldn't it? Would a jury? But I'm not sure you give any weight. We don't give any weight to it. Why
would I would give a weight, especially in light of the other factors of this confession. I mean, we know, and I'm not saying what happened in other cases is relevant here in these cases, but there have been four people in Illinois that have confessed to murders on death row who didn't do the crime. And this type of confession is not very reliable. He hadn't slept for 2 days.
Well, you're in effect saying that he became delusional.
Yes.
Is there any medical evidence that that type of delusions occur when you have that particular mixture, alcohol and cocaine?
The expert indicated that it could. All right.
Could.
Yes, it could. That's right. I mean, he wasn't there. I mean, he couldn't. I mean, it could have happened. I mean, the prosecutor himself wrote the statement up and added stuff to it. He was lying down. I mean, it could. I mean, there's a lot of.
This is not a person who's. This is a person who is not, you know, hauled in and questioned and so on. He volunteered. That's what's so unusual.
It is unusual. There's no question about it. And
I mean,
that was
someone who's arrested. He's a suspect. Might be browbeaten. But when the person actually goes up to the police and says he wants to confess to a murder.
There's no question that's an unusual fact. That's been going through my mind. But there's so many unusual things about this case. Maybe he was romantic.
I mean, it is true, is it not, that every day, it seems, some lunatic walks into a police station and says, I've killed...
That's right.
Or I'm the... this murderer and I'm that.
And that's correct. I mean, there are other things in the facts of this record. They had interviewed him before, and he was willing to take a polygraph test. They never polygraphed him. And then there is, and grant you, it's not as strong as which we want it to be, there is indications that there's other people that possibly could have done the crime. You know, I'm not going to tell you that this is the best possible evidence that we would want on the Ron Baker issue, but it's still out there. There's some confusion. This group of people out there that people were socializing with are rather unusual.
The fellow the wife of the deceased took off to Florida with, was he ever investigated?
There was some degree of investigation, yes. That was not ultimately one of the issues.
Was the wife ever under investigation?
The wife was under investigation and hired a lawyer and refused to make any statements. I mean, so when you look at, you know, I mean, our position ultimately, when you look at all the issues as a whole, a lawyer not could necessarily prove that he's innocent, but could create a reasonable doubt that he didn't commit the crime. They could have created a more than a negligible chance.
What about this double-edged character of the testimony that, after all, it was he whom she tried to hire to kill her husband, so... Could that really be kept from the jury?
I think it could. I mean, at one point in oral argument in front of Judge Grady, he thought that a motion would have been granted. That he indicated, I mean, I don't want to stretch whatever that record is, but he thought that really wasn't the crux of the problem at the time. His opinion ultimately gave some other indication. But I think it is an important factor whether the motion in limine would have to be granted. I mean, another more experienced lawyer, the lawyer that ultimately did the motion suppress and that was removed from the case, was concerned about that.
I mean, couldn't the prosecutor in question or ask her who she... Because you would cross-examine her and say, isn't it true that, you know, you tried to hire somebody to kill your husband?
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't the prosecutor ask who?
Well, and on motion limine would supposedly keep that out.
No, but I mean, but wouldn't it be legitimate for him to ask who, why, what made you do it?
Well, I don't think so. If it's going to be granted as an issue,
you could ask her about her motive, or
what?
You don't think he could ask her about her motive?
I don't think so. That would be one of the parameters. I mean, that would have to be ironed out before trial, but I think so. And then there is the question. And I'm not saying, I mean, what I can say...
It's awfully speculative because...
I think that, you know, I mean, I think that there's a high likelihood that they could probably keep it out. I think so. I mean, it's some critical information that the character of this key witness should have been brought before.
But you want to besmirch the character of the witness. That's your whole purpose.
Well, that's
protecting their client's character. It seems a little one-sided.
I don't think so, because it's irrelevant. I think it's the character of that particular witness that the state
chose. Not really relevant, because she'd made this statement before she was suspected of this. Mm. So it's of marginal relevance for impeachment, but it's very valuable in besmirching her character.
And I think the defense is entitled to do that when she's bringing up, certainly bringing up prior inconsistent statements the first two times.
What was the basis of Mr. Picaro's being a suspect right after the event? He was on the list. Why?
I think that Martha Jackson made him a suspect. My recollection of the arrest reports, Martha Jackson did. And they brought him in for questioning. And
that would surely come out, wouldn't it?
I think so, they listed him as a suspect, yeah.
Because she had given testimony that corroborated his confession long before.
She gave corroboration on the Rutman. That's correct.
It wouldn't have been very damaging if that came out, that she put him on the list originally.
Yeah, but it's damaging that she originally didn't. I believe that it's damaging. And I think that when you look at the confession as a whole, is suspect. I mean, it is that unique twist about him coming in, but as Judge Robner said, people do come in and confess to the crime. Maybe he didn't write it, he didn't sign it, he didn't sign any Miranda warnings. Maybe he was fantasizing about being romantically involved with Nadine, but not really involved. I really couldn't say for sure, but obviously he was not in a stable condition. I would just sum up.
There is a reason that they call these drugs mind-altering drugs, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, he might have had an infatuation with her, and then whatever. I would sum up when you have to look at this case as an entirety, not one particular issue, and I believe that the client did not receive a fair trial.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Friedman. Mr. McCurry?
May it please the court. At trial, both of the parties were fully aware of Martha Jackson's solicitation of the petitioner to kill her husband. And they were aware of the petitioner's agreement to do so.
Since they were, how on earth did they fail to charge her when they had her sworn confession?
At the time of trial, she couldn't have been charged. The statute of limitations had run at that point. But even before that,
she hadn't agreed to waive her statute of limitations in her deal, I take it.
There was no deal. There's no evidence at all. There were allegations originally in the Illinois courts that there was a deal that wasn't revealed. After copious discovery in the district court, the petitioner has dropped that argument. There simply is no evidence of any deal. But they couldn't prosecute Martha Jackson because there was no corpus delicti. All they had was her statement. To prosecute her, what they would need was John Pecoraro. And they weren't going to get John Pecoraro and to testify against her. But more importantly, they were more interested in John Pecoraro as a suspect in the murder than in Martha Jackson.
But her affidavit did contained a sworn confession that wasn't available through the police reports, did it not?
Well, she had confessed orally to the police, and they put that in their report, which was tendered to the parties.
Wasn't there an affidavit of hers that?
There was, in order to obtain a confidential overhear. Yes. But there was no corroboration of that.
You're saying she couldn't be convicted just on a bare conviction.
Exactly.
A bare confession. There had to be corroboration.
Yes. And the only source that I can think of where that would come from would be the petitioner.
Then, I mean, forgive me, but what's sort of the difference? I mean, she confesses, he confesses.
Well, there was corroboration. Excuse me.
Yeah.
there was corroboration for his confession. There was no corroboration for her confession to solicitation. All there was her, that document and her statements to the police. There was nothing at all to corroborate it. Her husband was still alive. So. The defense at trial was fully aware of all the facts regarding the solicitation matter, so there was certainly no discovery violation here. If they wanted to bring out the fact of the solicitation, they were free to do so. If she denied it at trial, which would be highly unlikely, they had at least five witnesses who would have testified to her statement regarding the solicitation, the detectives and the assistant state attorneys who spoke with her. So it is that counsel, or the petitioner, stresses the fact that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to bring this out during the course of the trial. First of all, whether to have used it is a matter of trial strategy. I think in this case, the decision to refrain from using it was a prudent exercise of trial strategy. As already pointed out, if trial counsel had attempted to try to establish a bias on the part of Martha Jackson on the basis of the police decision not to prosecute her for solicitation and therefore give to the jury the appearance of a deal with Martha Jackson and the police or the state attorney's office, if he had tried to do that, first of all, the force of that evidence would be extremely weak, because at the time she made the statement to the police regarding the solicitation, there was no case in which she could testify. Pecoraro had not been arrested. There was no pending case. It would be highly unlikely that the police would offer her freedom in exchange for her testimony in a trial in a case which didn't exist. Secondly, if counsel had brought this out, as the court pointed out, the prosecution could have, on rebuttal, certainly brought out the fact that before there was any motive to fabricate, that is, before the solicitation episode, Martha Jackson had given to the police a statement which was fully consistent with her trial testimony. And that occurred shortly after the murder, and several months before the solicitation incident. Not bringing this out was a prudent exercise on the part of trial counsel, because what trial counsel was trying to do throughout the trial was attack the statement of Mr. Pecoraro, which was made some 3 years after the murder. If Martha Jackson had been allowed to testify on rebuttal that she gave this statement immediately after the murder, it would indicate to the jury that John Pecoraro had been a suspect and the police were after him throughout this time. And it would cut down the force of the defense argument that John Pecoraro disappeared out of the blue, as the district court said in its opinion, and confessed to a police officer on the street 3 years later. For another reason, it was indeed prudent for counsel to refrain from going into this matter, because as the court here and the district court pointed out, there was a great likelihood that the prosecution would have brought out the fact that the person she solicited and the person who agreed to kill her husband was John Pecoraro. That would have been extremely disastrous for the defense case. In this case, both parties were aware of the solicitation episode. Both parties stayed far away from it at trial for their own reasons. There therefore was certainly no discovery violation here, and there was no ineffective assistance of counsel. He had good reasons for not touching this whole matter. Um, In the course of his argument, the petitioner also alludes to the expert testimony, or the allegation he makes that trial counsel was ineffective for not having an expert testify regarding the effect of drugs and alcohol on the petitioner at the time he walked up to Officer Becker on the street. As the district court found, in order to present the doctor's testimony, there would have to be some factual basis for it. The only factual basis, because the doctor's opinion was based on his conversations with the petitioner.
Did you concede the admissibility of the expert testimony?
The admissibility? No, indeed not. It perhaps would be admissible if there was a basis for it, and the only basis could have come from the petitioner testifying himself as to his use of alcohol and drugs that night, which would mean he would have had to testify at trial despite his prior murder conviction.
The state never conceded the admissibility of the expert testimony?
I don't think the state ever said one way or the other about whether it was admissible or not. It's certainly not admissible in itself, as the district court pointed out, that there had to be some basis for the doctor's opinion other than his conversations with the petitioner. This issue was presented to the Illinois Supreme Court in appeal from the denial of post-conviction relief, and the Illinois court simply found that there was no prejudice, which is not an unreasonable conclusion based on acceptable law, because there was no indication in the doctor's report of how likely it was that this person was, at the time he walked up to Officer Becker on the street and confessed, that he would have done so only as a result of the ingestion of drugs and alcohol. That's a reasonable conclusion reached by the appellate court, by the Illinois Supreme Court. But as the district court pointed out, there are other reasons why counsel wasn't ineffective for not presenting the experts. That is, he would have had to supply a basis for the opinion by calling the petitioner in this case. Petitioner also alluded briefly in his argument to evidence of a third-party admission on the part of one Ron Baker to the killing of Jimmy Christian. That's an argument which was made in the Illinois courts and in the district court. As a result of the discovery in the district court, it was firmly established that there just was no such statement ever made.
Is the appellant wrong at page 37 of the brief when it says it must be noted that the state stipulated that the testimony of Dr. Hemrick will be admitted as the affidavit of Dr. Hemrick, incorporating both of Dr. Hemrick's affidavits, and that the state raised no objection to Dr. Hemrick's qualifications? Agreed stipulation number 6, affidavits of Lewis Hemrick, PhD?
My interpretation of that, Your Honor, is that if the doctor's testimony was admissible, that's what it would have been, that the material contained in his report would have been substantially what he would have testified to. There was never a question of whether it was admissible. It was just a question of whether counsel was ineffective for attempting to admit it. For these reasons, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I'm not going to get the time.
No.
It would take too long. Go ahead.
Okay. For these reasons, we would ask this court to affirm the district court's denial of relief to the petitioner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McCurry. Mr. Friedman, how much time does he have?
3 minutes. There's agreed stipulation. We certainly thought that parties agreed to authenticity and admissibility of all documents attached without waiving any objection to materiality and relevancy. So they agreed to the admissibility and just to make the arguments as to materiality and relevancy.
Well, if it's irrelevant, it's inadmissible. It
yeah.
sounds like words. Let me ask you this: if your predecessor had been permitted to cross-examine Martha Jackson about the solicitation agreement, your opponent would have been permitted to argue, wouldn't he, that she wouldn't have said this in exchange for a promise of leniency because they couldn't prosecute her on the basis of a bare confession.
She would not have known that, though. And I
mean, that's a separate point. The prosecutor could certainly have made the point. That certainly would be legitimate redirect.
I don't think so. I mean, that's almost like a
really?
I don't think so.
Trying to trim and cut all this evidence. So the other thing is, suppose you'd. I think that if she had been cross-examined on this, and if it had been discovered that Pecoraro was the person whom she had hired, then you'd be back here arguing ineffective assistance of counsel. You would say it was utterly reckless for this person, by cross-examining Jackson on a peripheral point, since she had already given the statement, to open the door to Pecoraro, to Pecoraro being identified as the murderer for hire.
I don't know if I would argue that. I might.
Of course you would argue it, and you would be right to argue it. Even if the lawyer got a ruling in limine excluding reference in Pecoraro, you would never know how the actual course of questioning would go and whether she would say something that would open the door to allow the prosecutor to ask her about Pecoraro.
And then
you'd be right back here.
But I would
this is a case where the lawyer had a genuine, difficult, strategic choice to make, and either way he makes it, he's accused of ineffective assistance.
I would probably be arguing that he shouldn't have been allowed in, that the lawyer should have objected to allowing that Pecoraro was the one. That's how I would probably
It depends on the course of the questioning.
Well, I mean...
It depends on what she says, what her lawyer asks her.
It depends on how they handle the motion in limine, and a good lawyer would
What if it's a simple question? They ask her, isn't it true that you solicited someone to murder your husband? And she said, yes, I hired Pecoraro to murder my husband.
And now,
a limiting instruction?
Well, at that point, there should have been a motion in limine instructing...
Wait a second. Suppose this is what happens.
I would have moved for a mistrial.
Of course you would have moved for a mistrial. What if the judge said, I'm going to give a limiting instruction?
I still would have moved for a mistrial.
But the motion is denied, and the judge said, I'm going to give a limiting instruction.
Then the issue would be the
You would certainly be saying that lawyer was reckless to cross-examine her about this peripheral point, what she said, when she just repeated what she told the police before any problem arose.
I don't think he's reckless if he got a motion in limine granted. That's the purpose of the motion in limine. Now, if the motion in limine wasn't granted, that's obviously a different story. But if the motion in limine is granted, I mean, that's...
Motion in limine is granted, but always with the understanding that if circumstances change during the trial, it can be the ruling on a motion in limine can be re-examined.
Well, that would be the issue on appeal, and the question is whether the judge should have moved loud mistrial.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
Of course, thank you for accepting the appointment and your vigorous efforts on behalf of the client. And thank you, Mr. McCurry. The case will be taken under advisement, and court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.